We could probably spend an hour just talking about the way people use the word literally these days. You know, I literally died when he told me. Anybody who can say that obviously is not telling the literal truth. And that's just one star in a constellation full of changes in the English language that you've probably noticed in just your lifetime. Our next guest tracks those changes in an eye-opening book called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, in parentheses, like literally. John McWhorter is the author. He thinks about language all the time. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. His shorter pieces about language have appeared in major papers and magazines, and John is the author of 16 books, including Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue. John McWhorter, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So given the mishmash that English is, should we ever be surprised at its evolution?
No, we shouldn't. And what it comes down to is not a tired idea such as that we have to get used to change because the world is moving faster or something like that. It's inherent to any human language, no matter what the conditions are, to change all the time in the same way as cloud formations are always changing in the sky. If there were a society of people who were living in a dark cave for 2,000 years, the language they spoke when they came out of the cave after 2,000 years would be quite different from the one that they were speaking when they went in. So I think it's easy for us to miss that language is an inherently mutable thing. So it's not about your personal philosophy. It's not about the fact that we now have computers or that there's something going on with young people today. This is the way all languages have always been.
So are the complaints happening in other languages at the same time? I mean, do people who speak French or German also lament about people using terms like literally incorrectly?
They do. Cultures differ in how much language policing of that kind there is. But what it really comes down to is that when a language is written down, there is a natural illusion that somehow what's on the page is the real thing and that any departure from it is some kind of mistake. Once you have print, language looks like it sits still. But the thing is, only about 200 languages are written in any real way. Most languages, and there are 7,000 languages, are only spoken, and that's the way all language was until just 6,500 years ago. And so what it is that the printed page gives us an illusory sense that a language is something that sits still, or more to the point, that a word is a thing, when really, in any language, a word is a process.
Well, and you know, people really shouldn't be surprised then when you get right down to, particularly, you know, we're talking to you from the town where the Oregon Shakespeare Festival is located, and there are so many young people who think, "I can't. What are they saying? I don't get it."
Mm-hmm. Although, of course, a lot of people would also say that no, they do get it, and that Shakespeare's language is simply poetic, or that it comes across more easily if somebody is British, or it's a matter of training. But I think we all know the real truth, which is that when you listen to Shakespearean language delivered live, not reading it on the page, but when it's going by you really quickly, it can be really hard to get more than the gist, especially in the more serious plays. And the reason for it is not that it just that it's poetic. It's not just that the ideas can be complex. It's that even though the words are familiar to us, words' meanings are always changing in subtle ways such that after centuries, a great many of the words just don't mean what we think they mean. So if a Shakespearean character says generous, they mean noble. They don't mean magnanimous. We hear them say generous, and so we think about magnanimity, and we assume that that's what they mean. It doesn't quite match with what they're talking about, and then we just have to let something else go by, and then there's something else confusing. It's just because language changes.
Well, so, and Shakespeare gives some great examples in there, and you provide those in the book. I mean, just gobs of words. And let me take this on two approaches. Number one, words that have changed in usage, but didn't Shakespeare himself also use things deliberately differently himself?
I don't know if we can necessarily say that. Often we're told that Shakespeare was the first person to use a word, when really it's that his use of the word is the first one that has come down to us in print. But once again, print is a highly artificial thing. While he was writing, there were people talking all the time. And often, especially with the internet sources we have now, we find that Shakespeare wasn't always the very first person to use the word in print. Now, because Shakespeare was a towering artist, of course, he used language in creative ways, but that's not why, quite often, when we hear a Shakespearean character saying something rather ordinary, we can't quite hear it the way people would have heard it at the time, because the words simply don't mean the same things now that they did that.
Okay, I don't want to get totally stuck on Shakespeare. Let's go to the other major whipping boy of the period, which is literally, it just gets mentioned a few times in the early going. Is this the biggest spike of disagreement in the language currently?
It just seems to pop up a lot in comment sections and in questions, and people are annoyed because it seems that literally is supposed to mean by the letter. And it turns out that these days it can mean figuratively, and so it seems that there's this word that is being used to mean its opposite. But the problem is, words' meanings change, and so the idea that the original meaning was somehow the real one is another product of that illusion that print gives us. And more to the point, it's all about clarity. And this is what's important. Clarity matters. Do we understand the meaning? Language is for communication. And I don't think most of us would say that we don't know what someone means when they say they were literally dying of thirst. We know that what they're doing is highlighting a figurative statement. They're being a vivid speaker. And as to the idea that there's something wrong with a word having come to have two meanings that are opposite, frankly, there's a whole list of words like that in the English language, such as fast. Fast means rapid. But then how come you can say stuck fast or fast asleep? You know, it seems that that would be the antithesis of rapidity. Whole list of what's called contronyms. Literally has become one of them, and I think it's rather cool, although I understand why it irritates people, because the page sits there, presenting that illusion.
Uh-huh. Well, it's great that you use the word cool to describe it as well, because that was a word that came along in my childhood that came to mean something it hadn't originally. And I'm curious about why that stuck around a while. We'll come back to that one. We're talking to John McWhorter, who's the author of Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter, and any examples you would like to offer up as well. It's a rich field of conversation, and you can join us by phone or by email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. The Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John McWhorter, who is an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He's given us a real book for our times, in the sense that our times include people using words in ways they didn't used to use them. And he says, you know what? That happens throughout history. His book is called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. Like, literally. You have probably lots of examples you'd like to offer up. We'd like to hear them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, John, does the language change because we feel the current set of words just doesn't quite work for us, or we misunderstand them, or how do these things happen?
No, Jeff, I'm glad that you asked that question. Words' meanings change for the same reason, in a way, that cloud formations change. There's wind, and so the wind means that those shapes are never going to stay the same way. With language changing, of course, there's an extent to which people invent new words to mean new things, or new concepts come in and a word comes to cover the meaning for that concept. But really, more to the point, it's just that when we use a word in a given meaning, inevitably there's certain echoes of some extension of the meaning that are hanging around. And what we sense the word meaning has a way of creeping along into what those extensions are. And so, for example, if a Shakespeare character says generous and what they mean is noble, well, especially then, a noble, part of being a noble, was to exhibit a kind of generosity in terms of giving to the public, being part of the society, in return for not basically having your castle burned down. And so, after a while, you would start to associate the noble people with a certain generosity, and after a while, that word came to mean generous, and it lost the whole connotation of being part of the elite. And what's important is that that's not peculiar. It's not that some words have these who to thunk it sorts of pathways. That's what's happening to almost all words all the time, because of, you could call it misunderstandings, but it's really enriched understandings. The words kind of ooch around while there are all these meanings that need to be conveyed. And after a while, you have things being conveyed by brand new words that nobody would have thought. Apple used to just mean fruit. it came to mean this particular fruit that I find rather overrated. And now we have this other word that means fruit in general. And all of that is the way all languages have always worked. It's magnificent to see, but I think that in our society, we tend to think of it within the short span of our lifetimes as some sort of decay or peculiarity. So Words on the Move is a jolly book, and I'm trying to give people a new sense of how language works, despite the magnificence of dictionaries.
Are we often unaware of the changes as they happen? And case in point is when people started saying long story short a couple of years ago, my wife was the one who said, how long have you been saying that? And I realized, oh, I don't know. I'm not even sure where I got it from. And I really couldn't tell you.
You know, I would say that I first became aware of that watching The Sopranos. And so that would go back to around 2000. And you can assume that the writers who put that into those characters' mouths had heard it long before then. So often we don't know the sorts of things that are happening. One of those for me is I'm going to head out, which is a kind of gentle way of saying that you're going to leave some sort of gathering without being so abrupt as to say I'm leaving. I somehow missed learning that until a couple of years ago, and it's very useful. And yet if I think about it, people have been saying it for at least, this is just my guess, not systematic. I'm sure people were saying that when I was in college in the 80s, although it would be easy for me to think, oh, it's a neologism. So yeah, these things creep in and we don't think about it because we have other things to think about than the fact that the meanings of words are changing, but they're always doing it.
Well, I remember being aware of this a bit as a kid because the word cool began to be used for things that were, well, really neat, I guess, was probably what preceded that.
Exactly.
Before long, cool had turned into that's tough. But tough didn't hang on. Somehow cool has managed to transcend, even though there's been fat and sick and any one of a number of other ways to describe things as cool.
Yeah, there's an aspect of language change that really is a matter of chance. I'm not sure we could say why cool has somehow stuck and not become the marker of any particular generation, while every generation has its versions of it, wicked and fierce and currently sick, where you get the feeling that they're only going to hold on for so long. There's something pleasing about cool, but I'm sure that if you rolled the tape back, people would say the same thing about, you know, peachy keen and neat. I say neat, and I think it's beginning to date me. But, you know, you can tell sick isn't going to hold on, but with a lot of them, really, I think it's just chance. And chance can be fun as well, although, as I say in the book, if you over-rely on chance, people feel like you're not explaining anything, you're not doing the proper science. But there's an extent to which it really is just a matter of the roll of the dice, such that language change is like sport. If you think of it as something that you sit in a chair and watch, you can't know how it's going to come out, which thing is going to win, and it's fun to see what does, as long as you get away from the idea that the changes you're hearing are just mistakes made by people who are too young to know better.
Fun is the central artery of John McWhorter's book on language. It's called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally, he adds to that. I remember, though, that if you try to make deliberate changes to the language, you can discover that it doesn't really work. I remember at the peak of its popularity, MTV tried to put new words into the language, and it just blew up. Nothing happened. People, I mean, even as cool, tough, neat, wicked, whatever you want to say, MTV was at the time, it didn't catch on.
No, it's hard to introduce new things on purpose, and it's especially hard to try to change thought with language. It seems like such a noble mission. And you can nudge thought along by coming up with new terms for things because the old term accreted pejorative meanings. But the truth is that if the thought doesn't change, then it's kind of like, you know, gnats that keep on coming back or rust that settles onto something, the negative associations are going to keep coming back. And so there used to be something called home relief, and that sounded wonderful and humane. People started to despise the notion of anybody being on home relief. Welfare was a replacement.
Oh, yeah.
And if you think about what a beautiful word that is, imagine how people meant it. And yet, welfare now has all these, you know, disgusting implications. So now we have cash assistance. That's going to last about 20 years, and then there's going to have to be another term until thought changes about people needing money to survive. And that goes for handicapped and all of the other terms that consist of these rolling euphemisms, as Steve Pinker has put it. It's not that people are deliberately trying to keep us off of our balance. It's that thought has a way of settling in. Words alone cannot change thought.
You know, it's interesting because it goes beyond just what words mean, but how they sound. And I guess it doesn't surprise me to find out with the GH in there that daughter used to be pronounced something other than daughter.
Yeah, it was dafter. It's very interesting. You can read the Salem witch trials and things from that period. And people are writing it D-A-F-T-E-R, and it's clear that that's the way it was pronounced, which doesn't surprise you when you think about how laughter was spelled. And so if we went back in time, a lot of people think that, well, if we listened to earlier American English, everybody would have a British accent and there'd be the occasional archaic word used. No, people would have not a British accent necessarily, because the British accent itself that we know now has changed. But people would just sound funny. There would be all sorts of pronunciations that would be a little odd. Their vowels were different from ours. Nobody in 1760 sounded anything like, say, the people who we hear on NPR today. Or more to the point, nobody sounded like that in 1950, because the vowels are always changing around in ways that we never think about. It's fun. It's really a lot of fun.
I notice you're a little hard on the dictionary. You call it that it gives stark, misleading portraits of language?
I don't remember putting it that way, although it sounds like something I would have said. My problem with the dictionary is not that anybody who writes them is doing anything wrong, but the idea that you open up the dictionary and you see what a word means and you say, this is what it means, and therefore anything that departs from that is some sort of mistake. It simply doesn't correspond with the way any language always has to be. And it's not that I have any problem with the idea of things being preserved. In real life, I'm kind of an antiquarian person. I don't like change. But language cannot sit still. And it's not because young people are fun. It's because our brains have a way of accreting words with new resonances. And next thing you know, the word has to mean something different. So the dictionary is great, but the dictionary is a photo album. It's exactly like the photo album full of Polaroids that you have from 1978. You don't look at the Polaroids and say, that is Aunt Belle. No, that was Aunt Belle, and then she moved on. You moved on from those pictures. So, yeah, dictionaries are great. They are magnificent photo albums, but they're instantly out of date. Language itself doesn't sit still like a dictionary does.
Does language change faster in the age of the Internet? I seem to get surprised every so often by somebody saying, well, I'm fully woke now, and I have no idea what they mean.
No. Actually, the truth is that language changes faster when it's not written. And so if we were speaking a rainforest language where you just speak into the air and that's it, you can look at a language like that and come back 100 years later and often complete changes have happened such that it can be almost a different language sometimes. Once there's writing, things tend to sit a little harder. There is no empirical proof that I'm aware of that more things are happening now as the result of the Internet than were happening as the result of, say, teletype and newspapers and radio and television in 1950. It just feels like it because we discuss it more.
Lots of people want to talk to John McWhorter about his book, Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. First email comes from Debbie in Talent, who says, I have heard nonplussed used to mean upset and calm. Which is it, and are we ever plussed?
We're not plussed because that doesn't happen to have happened, but that word means both things. And it's because it seems to confuse people, the original meaning. But it's gotten to the point where such a critical mass of people are using it in the new way that we have no choice but to decide that change has happened. Now, of course, if some one person is doing something and it doesn't spread, then we can certainly call it a mistake. I knew somebody who for some reason said nerfree and grofree instead of nursery and grocery, and this was a crisply articulate person with no problems whatsoever, very articulate person, but with that particular slight peculiarity that you would notice only if you knew her for a long time. That qualified as a mistake because nobody says nerfree and nobody says grofree, or if somebody says something that really does interfere with clarity. But with nonplussed, it's a word where the meaning has changed, and it's actually happened very much within living memory, and so I think we have to accept it as cool rather than as a mistake, because too many people are making this mistake for it to qualify as one. It has become a new aspect of the language.
So nerfree and grofree weren't regional or neighborhood things like Cockney?
No. This was just something odd about this person.
All right. Call here from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter, the author of Words on the Move.
Dudes.
Hey,
like
man.
I'm digging this groovy rap, you know what I mean? I've noticed in the last year or so lots of people, and now I'm doing it myself, beginning sentences with the word so, seemingly inappropriately from the way I learned English when I was younger. Do you have any comments on that? And thank you.
Thank you,
Lester. Yeah, babies.
You know, that is a very common comment, and that usage of so isn't as new as we're often told. You can find examples of it early in the 20th century. There is some evidence that it has something to do with the Yiddish spoken by many immigrants who came to the United States at that time. So, like literally, seems to irritate a lot of people for reasons that I genuinely don't quite understand. I know exactly the usage that you mean, and I've always just thought it was something that people said. But it's interesting, any language has a way of indicating what that so means when we use it. It actually has meaning. It has a function, this so. It indicates a kind of shared knowledge among all of the people. It's a graceful way to begin a new topic. We call it a discourse marker. And if you think of words as being what's in the dictionary, then that so, because most dictionaries are not going to mention that particular usage, seems like some kind of excrescence. But to someone like me, I hear it as part of a language developing what's called the pragmatic, and it's a term I don't use that much in the book because it's a very awkward term. But there's a lot of machinery in any language that serves to indicate how we feel about what we're saying, to manage the rules of conversation, to monitor what's in the person we're talking to's head. And that stuff is every bit as much grammar as endings for past tense and indefinite articles. But linguists tend not to share it with the public. Words on the Move tries to get across that there's this whole realm that they kind of don't want you to know about. So is one of those things.
Well, you know, there are ways in which so is used, I think, and I use it to indicate that I've heard somebody. You know, when somebody's answered a question, I say, so you're saying such and such. I mean, it's the lever to get in.
Yeah, and it means therefore. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so is a very useful word. It has proliferated massively in a way which you can think of as that sport that I'm talking about. You think, well, what's going to happen to the word so? And wow, quite a bit has happened to it.
Hmm. Another call here from Lane in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter.
Hi. So as you're talking about the fluidity of language as far as like English or perhaps European languages, I'm curious, like with Chinese, with such a long history of, you know, written language, whether or not the you see the same fluidity. I mean, I imagine you would because we're all humans, but still, if you've seen the same fluidity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely, definitely. And there's a strong prescriptive tradition in Chinese. It can be hard as a linguist type like me to even deal with Chinese from actual speakers because there's a sense that the way it's written is the real thing and that the way ordinary people speak is somehow a mistake. You know, this is a worldwide phenomenon when something's written. But what we call Mandarin Chinese, actually out down on the ground, is really a great many practically different languages. Whatever you learn in school is quite different from anything anybody's speaking, especially if you leave cities. And then even the other Chinese, it's time to stop calling them dialects. Languages like Cantonese, which is as different from Mandarin as French is from Spanish. Cantonese is no one thing. The Cantonese that most Chinese people we would meet in the United States speak is quite different from the Cantonese of Hong Kong. So spoken Chinese goes on and does its own thing like the clouds. The written kind of Chinese based on Mandarin, that has a way of staying the same. It's the same old story.
Those characters have been in use for thousands of years now, haven't they?
Yeah, it's wonderful in itself, but there is a tendency not to allow them to adjust to realities such as that the quote-unquote dialects of Chinese are languages, just like the Romance languages, and the system is designed to write Mandarin, but it's much harder to get it to adjust to Cantonese or Taiwanese, and not much is done about that on the official level, because like us, the Chinese think of what's on the page as real and what's spoken as an accident, when really it's like it's weather and clouds, languages like that.
So the idea of rules of language, is this something that is relatively recent in human history, maybe 19th century?
Well, for English, people became especially concerned about such things really in the late 18th century, and it had to do with the development of a large middle class with a bourgeois sensibility and a sense that this language called English was now on the world stage and therefore needed to be tidied up a bit, especially because this came after a culture in which Latin and Greek were thought of as the real languages, again, because they had long written histories and they had been languages of empire. And so the idea that you're saying it wrong becomes especially prevalent only a few centuries ago in English. That's not the way people thought of English in, say, Chaucer's time, when you see massive variation on the page and people thought of it as relatively interesting, but the idea that you were going to make a mistake in saying this thing rather than the other hadn't settled in. We could take a page from them.
Does a lot of the resentment come then from people who feel like they are obeying the rules, I speak it correctly, that sort of thing?
Well, of course. One is proud of such things.
Well said, as always. John McWhorter's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. You've heard the cloud example. Language is like clouds. Words change over time. We'll come back and pick up the conversation. We have a phone call waiting and a couple of emails as well. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John McWhorter. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and the author of many books and articles, including one called a book called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, which has given birth to another book called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. In parentheses, like literally. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about language and its changes and maybe our pet peeves about those. 800-838-3760 to get in by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Email from John, no town given. He says, I often hear the phrase in terms of added into a sentence, but if you omit the phrase, the sentence is quite understandable and it seems unnecessary. So I guess the larger question is why people add bits to language that you could actually slice out and still get the same meaning.
Yeah, we want to be clear. There is an urgent emotional aspect to language. Part of speaking is constantly assuring people that we really mean what we're saying. And inevitably, that means a certain amount of redundancy, but it's a matter of deciding what we consider redundant. And so, for example, people will say, well, she rose up, and why do you need the up? Isn't that contained in the rose? Or you can sink down, which sounds fine, but really sink would be better. Or overwhelm. You think, well, overwhelm. Well, if over is the excessive part, what did whelm mean? Whelm meant overwhelm. And overwhelm is something that happened because of that kind of redundancy, because people like to be vivid. So, yeah, that happens all the time. Linguists call it redundancy. Any language basically has a way of signaling various things more than once. And as often as not, the original thing wears away. For example, in overwhelm, we don't think of whelm as meaning anything. And things keep going. And so you don't get to the point where a language is so weighed down by repetition that people can't speak. And the way we know that is because there's 7,000 languages and there's not one of them that's like that. But yes, language is not like a computer code. There is a good deal of repetition. Think of it more as DNA with a lot of the junk DNA involved.
Right. When I think of people using terms like in terms of, though, it seems like that's the kind of situation where people are giving presentations or getting into bureaucratic speak, which brings me to things like adding -ization to just about every verb in the world, including I have seen people call it analyzation when the word analysis would have been just fine.
Well, that just means that people are trying to sound intelligent. I mean, that is a fashion, that is an affectation, and of course, affectation takes many forms. It's going to happen in language as well. One finds that those things tend not to catch on. Of course, if they did, then we'd have to talk about language change again. But those are more a matter of creativity.
Mark in Talent writes, if the goal of language is clarity, wouldn't it be better if words did retain their meaning forever? It seems like the changing of the meaning of words works against clarity.
Well, you know, I don't think it does. You know, I kind of like the idea that the language would always stay the way it is. It would seem less messy, it wouldn't challenge us the way it does, but there's never been discovered a language that had a clarity problem. And I know that sounds rather glib, but it actually answers the question. There's 7,000 languages, and linguists have analyzed a great many of them. And there are various unusual things that you find, but never has anybody found a language where it turned out that change made it so that people were having trouble understanding one another. That's something you think of as part of a science fiction novel, but it's never happened because language maintains this kind of clarity because what it's for is communicating clearly. Nothing works against that. And so things change, but they change in ways that continue to allow people to communicate. So I get the point of the question, but I'm not sure what we would consider better about it staying the way it is because it doesn't hurt anything for it to change.
Has any society ever mandated this language? You know, these are the way these words are used. This will stay this way, and kind of like in 1984 and the Big Brother government, deciding how words are going to be used. Has it ever gotten to that point where somebody rigidly said this language is not going to change?
No, it wouldn't work unless it was a society such as what they attempted in that one, where nothing changed at all. No. I mean, in a way, we try to do it by saying this is what the word means in the dictionary, but people keep talking, and most of us don't walk around with dictionaries in front of us, and so the language keeps on changing. But if society changed, then no matter what we said about what a word is supposed to mean, those resonances would start creeping in, and actual usage would differ from what was in this manual that people put out.
All right, we have a call here from Barbara in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter, the author of Words on the Move. Barbara, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I feel that the word gentleman is used incorrectly these days because when they describe a murderer or someone who's committed rape, they say the gentleman did it. And in the old days, a gentleman wouldn't do a thing like that.
Okay, good point. Thanks
That's
for that.
That's interesting. That usage of gentleman is meant to convey that we are supposed to be neutral in our judgment towards somebody until they've been officially convicted. And so it is a kind of affectation that's become so common that I think we have to accept it as a derived usage of gentleman. What it really means is person respectfully presumed innocent until. But yes, if you read a newspaper 100 years ago, such people would not be called gentlemen, and they might be called ruffians or miscreants or something like that. Many people would say that was judgmental in an unpleasant way. So opinions will differ.
Heidi from Medford writes, what happened to the English grammar for who instead of for whom? To whom it may concern. People say for he and I instead of for him and me. We would never say for I, so why has it changed? Learning a foreign language helps to learn our own grammar, she says. Unfortunately, TV announcers are the worst abusers.
Well, whom is something which, and I mean, I enjoy how it's to be used, just like anybody who likes grammar, but we wouldn't be using whom very much if it weren't for certain grammarians whose heyday was especially the late 1700s, who liked the idea that we should preserve whom because it makes English more like Latin, where case distinctions like that are rife in the language. And I think even to us, we kind of enjoy that we have to think about object versus subject in that case beyond the ordinary pronouns. But the truth is that we're a language that has very little case marking like that, such that the natural tendency is to use whom as little as possible. And the business about he and I and between you and I, that comes from the rule that we've been taught that you're not supposed to use me or him or them as subject. And as much sense as that seems to make, that too is something that the 18th century grammarians decided because that's how Latin works, when it's never been the way English works. If you say, who did that? The answer is him, not he, even though it's he who did it. You're using it as a subject. It's never been like that. And I know that's hard to stomach because grammarians have taught us this. We were taught this in school. We've learned to say Billy and I went to the store and we feel like we're doing the right thing and we're eating our vegetables. But the truth is, somebody just made it up. It was just made up in the late 1700s, and we are stuck with it now.
So who did it? The answer is him, unless you add another word, did, and then it becomes he did.
Right. It has to be he did. So who did it? Him. Well, that's not an object. None of us have ever only used those forms as objects. But that's not the way we're taught it in school, And so we're stuck with it. I'm hosting the podcast on Language Lexicon Valley at Slate. And my next one is actually going to be about this Billy and Me Went to the Store thing. Because it's actually very interesting why we think that's correct. And I think that it's more fun to see where that really came from and a different way of looking at when we should use it and why.
Sounds fun. Lexicon Valley, you said?
Lexicon Valley, that's the Slate podcast about language and linguistics. Sorry to give a plug, but frankly, I really love doing it, and I'm trying to get across fun things on that podcast.
Sounds like a fun time. Jeffrey in Ashland gets right into the wheelhouse of stuff you talk about in the book. He says, actually, seems to be overused so much. It seems to be a placeholder while one gets their thoughts together, and while it sounds perspicacious with its four intellectual-sounding syllables, it actually seems to be the newest version of like.
You know, that word has a function in the way it's often used, which is to indicate the counter-expectational or the counterintuitive. That's part of grammar that we're not taught about at the blackboard. The cat actually ate the rat. What we mean is that you wouldn't expect it. So it doesn't mean the cat ate the rat in reality. It has that very specific meaning. In other usages, people will say, well, actually. And once again, that's people who are signaling that they mean what they're saying, that they're being genuine. That's part of human conversation. And so, yeah, it's going to pop up in the pauses, and we're going to hear it a lot. But that's because it no longer means only in actuality or in reality. It's becoming a little piece of something like so. And we hear it a lot, and we think, why are people using that long word so often? But it doesn't mean what it meant 700 years ago.
Let's take a call about so. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John McWhorter.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Well, gentlemen, I have a comment and a question. I think that the word so is, it's actually the new word well, and I think well, being used at the beginning of sentences, is just basically a prefix so that the thinker can organize their thoughts till they can form the rest of the sentence. So it's sort of a pausing mechanism. And my question to you is, well, let's see. what is up with people taking nouns, putting the letters ing on the end of them, and turning them into verbs? What's up with that? I'd like to take the answer off the air if I could.
All right, we'll be tabling that one. Thanks, Jamie.
Well, nouns and becoming verbs is particularly something that seems to bother people, but really, it's quite normal. It's something that's happened in English all the time, partly because we don't have as many suffixes as many languages to get in the way of it. And so, view and copy are two words that began as nouns and became verbs. And if you don't mind those, then, you know, faxing and the rest can't really bother us. Structure is being used as a verb, and people think that's just not right. But that would mean that copy and view shouldn't be used as verbs either. And you're right about well and so. More specifically, well as so these days, often signals to indicate basic acknowledgement of and respect for what somebody else said when actually you're about to propose another analysis. And so if you say, well, horses run faster, what you mean is, yes, dogs are pretty quick, but horses run faster.
Which is a great example in the book. I mean, it really is different between horses run fast and well, horses run fast.
Completely different.
Which gets us into modal pragmatic markers, which I think we'll set aside. But let's talk about contronyms again. You brought those up earlier. And can you explain what those are?
Yeah. And so let's say you seed a watermelon. Does that mean that you're putting the seeds in? No. Even though, of course, you're used to putting seeds in the ground. Or fast, again, you're running fast, but then you can be stuck fast. These are called contronyms in that they can mean one thing and then it's opposite. And what's interesting about contronyms is that they're not confusing. None of us have ever been confused as to what someone meant by fast or by seed or by any words of that kind. And that's what's happened to literally as well. So there's a list of contronyms. And if we're made aware of all of them but literally, we think, oh, well, you know, who'd have thunk it? Those are the interesting wrinkles of English, and you feel kind of proud that you speak a language that has those little frills. Literally has just joined the list.
You do riff through actually and totally and stuff, and it's a Browner equivalent. And you know, I mean, without these, John, do you think that language can be overly precise and rather uncolorful?
Yes. If you didn't use you know and stuff, and also the profane version of and stuff, and totally, and all those little words where you have a hard time saying what they mean, you wouldn't be a human being. There are those words in any language. Once you're finished figuring out how you use the past tense, you want to figure out in a language how they would say, I even had a second house. What does even mean? It doesn't mean level. It's a different kind of even. Any language can say, I even had a pencil. Those are the sorts of things that make a language a language. And for arbitrary reasons, we aren't taught those things as grammar. We're taught those things as extra. We think of them as idioms. But really, they're just as systematic as how to mark the past tense. And without them, you're a computer, essentially. We all use them because that's how you communicate with a language rather than pretending to be a page.
What then do emoticons do to language, particularly for us English speakers?
They are serving the same function as these quote-unquote idiomatic quote-unquote little words like so and then and well and totally. They add the emotional, they add the commitment aspect of language to texting, which otherwise can seem rather cold and abrupt. It makes texting more like language.
Ah, okay. That's a good way to look at it. John McWhorter is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.